This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Summer movies have been playing in area theaters since May 2nd, I believe. But with summer about to officially start, we thought it time to talk about the films we're being offered during these warm months. As usual, there is a bumper crop of action films like The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Godzilla, X-Men, also a movie or two for kids like Disney's Maleficent, if that's for children, and How to Train Your Dragon 2. But are there any surprises, anything for adults to see, anything, in fact, worth spending money on? For answers to those questions, we turn to our trio of movie critics. Matt Brunson is back. He is film editor and arts and entertainment editor and, in fact, senior editor for Creative Loafing Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Maria Oliva is co-founder and film and theater review editor of Arts a la Mode, which covers arts in Charlotte and beyond at artsalamode.com. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, good morning.
And Sean O'Connell, movie content director for cinemablend.com, as well as countless other outlets, is here, and you can see him on WCNC NBC Charlotte. Welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here with you.
And thank you all for being here. And from what you've seen, from what you know about what's headed into theaters later on this summer, will this be a good summer movie season? Is it so far? And if so, for whom? For kids, for adults, or both?
I actually thought it got off to kind of a shaky, weak start with a lot of hype movies that didn't live up to the hype. But the last few weeks, I mean, I feel like Santa at Christmas. I've just been handing out positive reviews because I've been seeing a lot of good stuff these last two or three weeks. Hmm. So that was a good upturn.
Anne Marie?
I agree totally. It was a little disappointing. The Amazing Spider-Man 2, I wasn't thrilled with it. But as Matt says, the last couple of weeks have been really great.
And when you say it's been great for adults, been great for teenagers, been great for kids. For whom?
Everybody. When I think of the movies I've liked, it's kind of covered a wide mix for all audiences, teenagers, kids, and adults.
Is it my imagination, or have these big action blockbuster films, not just in the summer season, but perhaps earlier in the year, have they been falling on what's the eye equivalent for deaf ears? I guess blind eyes. Are people not going to see these films anymore?
It feels like they're going to less films. But these big blockbusters are catering to their target demographic in the opening weekend. And so each of these films, if you look at the summer blockbusters, they've all opened to around $90-something million, $91, $92, in that ballpark, and then they drop off. And there's been an interesting statistic that no film yet has crossed the $200 million mark that's opened in the summer season.
So what you're saying is that the real core audience for these films rushes to the theater the first weekend and nobody follows up.
Kind of. We have not seen a sustained hit yet. And now it's very early. And the two films that have crossed $200 million so far this whole year have been Captain America and the Lego Movie. And they were both word of mouth. Mm-hmm. Well, Lego Movie was a word of mouth hit. Captain America, we knew, would do well. It's just taking longer for films to hit these benchmarks. And I think there's a lot of different reasons. I think television factors in. I think it's summertime and people are choosing to go out.
Television's been around that for almost 60 years.
It's better now. It's much better.
A lot better.
The options are much better. So some of these summer blockbusters, the people who feel the need to see them on the big screen and in 3D, they go early.
And is it television, or is it the fact that we now have big screen television?
Sure, all of that.
Yeah.
All of that plays in.
And high definition.
I agree.
All right, this is one of the big times of the year for Hollywood, Christmas being another. And once again, no movie has crossed the $200 million mark. What's it take to make one of these big movies?
Money.
$200 million.
Yes.
Is it $200 million? Is it more than $200
million? Some of them. I think that's what X-Men cost, and that's about to pass $200.
But when you say nothing has hit $200 million, does that mean in America?
In America.
In America,
okay.
Yes. Yeah. International box office often saves the day.
So hasn't that always been the case? So they'll make their nut back even if they don't make it here.
With a lot of movies, yeah. It's not always a guarantee, though. Some movies don't sell overseas anymore.
So if movies aren't going to make $200 million and they cost that much or more to make, will we see Hollywood doing simpler films?
You'll see them doing familiar films. I think you'll see them only investing in properties that they think an audience is going to respond to. This is what's troubling about Tom Cruise's movie, The Edge of Tomorrow. Opened this past weekend to almost across the board favorable reviews. It was a very expensive film, and it didn't earn a lot of money because audiences didn't give it a chance. And that's
30.
Right. It made shy of $30 million. It lost to Maleficent in its second weekend and a very favorably reviewed Fault in Our Stars. But that's an indicator to studios, stop taking chances, give us more superheroes and sequels, because that's what audiences are going to respond to.
But he is kind of a superhero in that film. Tom Cruise plays this guy, if I'm right. not mistaken, who is a warrior who keeps coming back to relive the same battle.
He doesn't start out as a warrior, though.
Okay.
He starts out as a coward, basically. And because he has to relive a certain day over and over, he becomes a hero. It may have legs. I don't know.
It was a hard sell, too, because the title, Edge of Tomorrow, when you think about it, it's a cool title, but it just doesn't sound cool. They should have
called
it.
Sounds like a soap opera.
Yeah, they should have called it, Aliens or Kill or Cruise or something.
It was supposed to be called All You Need Is Kill.
Kill, the original source, which
right.
would have been better, but I guess it was kind of intimidating on a marquee.
So is the title the problem? Or is
Tom Cruise is the problem.
Is Tom Cruise the problem?
Well, we don't have movie stars anymore.
No.
I mean, we have movie stars, but we don't have people who can open a movie.
He's not a movie star? He's not somebody who can open a movie?
He used to be. You know, when you're at the top, there's only one way to go, and that's down. And somebody to sustain being at the top for that long, mm-hmm. it doesn't happen anymore. I think you're right.
I'd argue he's a movie star for sure, but he didn't open Oblivion. He didn't open Jack Reacher. He didn't open this. I mean,
he's a movie star, but he's not where he used to be.
Right.
And but again, it took Mission Impossible 4 for him to have a big hit, because everybody's like, oh, we know this title. We're going to go see this. So it's what Sean was saying. You know, if there's a familiarity there, it's going to help.
Is he alone in it having been eclipsed, or is it because of some of the personal behavior that has traveled, like jumping up and down on Oprah's
I think he
couch?
Got older, for one thing, and I think some of his fans maybe aged out. The jumping on the couch may be part of it, too. I just think in movies now you see them casting more and more stars in a movie to bring up the level. It's not just like one person
yes.
anymore. So they're realizing – and the other thing is, if you don't have a good story, it's very hard for an actor to transcend a bad story. It takes a really good actor. If you have a good story, everybody looks good. It's easier. So I think movies are changing in that sense, Sean. I agree with you. There are no more real stars.
But when you have HBO and Showtime and Netflix and people like that producing really, really compelling, well-executed material like Game of Thrones
–
who wants to go to the movies and spend $30 on popcorn and tickets and a soft drink when they can sit at home for $10 a month and really see some good material?
It's true. No, I mean, I don't follow Game of Thrones, but the reaction to the most recent episode was that it was better. This battle sequence was better than most of the things you've seen on screen in a theater.
Right.
So there are diehards who are still going to see almost everything that comes out on opening weekend. But I do think that audience is decreasing.
So let's begin talking about specific films. Let's talk with, I guess it was the first action film to be released this summer, which was The Amazing Spider-Man 2. It came out May 2nd. Why so early?
Well, I mean, some would argue that the season really started with Captain America in April. They're pushing the season forward.
Yeah.
And so I laughed when you said the summer is just about to start. It feels like the summer starts four different times.
Yeah.
Like it started in April. It starts on May 2nd. It starts on Memorial Day. It starts July 4th, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The studios want to cling to these weekends, but it's in reality the season is all year long because movies like Divergent open in March now, and Hunger Games proved you can open in November, and it's just all of these big seasons. But May 2nd is now deemed the opening weekend, and it seems to have been a superhero movie for the past 5 years. It's been Iron Man or the Avengers, or now it's Spider-Man. I am one of the loudest and strongest defenders of The Amazing Spider-Man, but it is underperforming, especially for something to have such a choice slot.
Well, with so many Spider-Men.
Well, sure.
Do we need another? And this is yet another reboot. They've gone back to the beginning again. Why? Why not propel the story forward?
Well, you could argue that after the part three of the Sam Raimi films, the initial trilogy, it would have been tough to keep building off of that. Like, you get to a point where the stars age out, the directors have gone through the villains that they could go through, and you start to get into second-tier villains. It's almost like when Nicholson did the Joker, you couldn't do the Joker if you kept going with Tim Burton and Michael Keaton. So they had to restart, and Christopher Nolan got to do them, and then he brought Heath Ledger in.
And are these getting to new audiences? Are these people who have not seen the original Spider-Man films?
Yeah. The box office on these two new ones are far less than the first three.
Well, that's my question. It cost them a gazillion dollars to produce these. Why not just – if they like sequels and they like the same stories over and over again, bring back the old film. Put them on the screen again. Why wouldn't you do that? Save money.
In August, Ghostbusters is coming back to the big screen. They can't get Ghostbusters 3 under production, so they're just going to bring the first one back with some additional scenes.
Well,
so
you can't really do that just because, like we were talking, everybody has huge screens at home now. And if you want to relive the first three Spider-Man movies, you can just do it at home.
Well, also, there's a lot at stake. I mean, when you put that much money into a movie, you're going to – I think there's a tendency to play it safe. That's why often my favorite movies are the independents, because they're about different things. They're different stories, and they take more chances. But when you're spending $150 and $200 million to make a movie, you have to say, I need some guarantees that I'm going to make that money at least back and more.
Well, they replaced Tobey Maguire with Andrew Garfield as Spidey.
Who doesn't look like a teenager.
No, he doesn't.
Or a nerd.
Jonah Hill.
Why did they replace Toby, and why with Andrew? Not Andrew. Yeah, Andrew Garfield. Why him?
It's a long story. I mean, it's a very long story. Theoretically,
it's a short story.
Sam Raimi wanted to keep making films with Tobey Maguire, but they fought with the studio about what direction they were going to go in. And so the studio decided, instead of keep going with this creative team, we're just going to start over. And Spider-Man seems to be one of those properties. There are a couple of properties like this where you can restart, in theory, and you can reintroduce a new Spider-Man. And this does have a different storyline to a certain extent, but it has to hit some of the familiar beats. So they went younger, and they went with a couple of different, you know, new characters and some familiar characters, like the Green Goblin is back. And it's flashier. It's aimed at a younger audience. And it's not working. I mean,
it's just too soon for one thing. I mean, like with the Batman movies, you had, at least a good decade, right. Superman, stuff like that. But this one, I mean, it's just a few years since the first trilogy, and people are like, well, we just saw this.
Sally Field plays his mom in this.
His aunt.
Well, who played it before?
Rosemary Harris.
Oh, okay.
Who is much much more accurate.
I like Sally Field.
She's great.
I love Sally Field. I just think she's miscast in this.
I like her. I really like her.
I love her. She's so good in it. She's so good. She's very entertaining in it.
So is it worth watching again?
Yes. Oh, I love these two films. I think these versions are much better than the originals, but these two disagree with me.
Anne-Marie gave it 3 stars. You gave it 2.5, Matt.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So didn't move me. Let me put it that way.
Oh, my gosh. It devastated me. Really? I think it's the most accurate depiction of the character. And there are storylines from the comics that the sequel plays out that I've been waiting to see, and I thought they did a great job.
And Anne-Marie gave it 3 stars and said that the real star in this is the CGI, 3D, and computer-generated scenes. Is that really a good review?
No, it's not a good – 3 stars out of 5 is not that great. No, I didn't feel it. I mean, I'm a good audience, and I want to like things. But and if I do like something, I'm all in. But I just couldn't connect with this that much. I'm not really sure why.
You didn't like it either, so tell me why didn't you connect
with it? Yeah, I liked it a little better than the first Amazing Spider-Man. I think the best element is the chemistry between Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy. But the problem that a lot of people had with Spider-Man 3, the Sam Raimi one, is that it had too many villains, and that's the problem here too, is there's so many bad guys that nobody really has a chance to develop as a character.
Why do they try to cram them all in one film as opposed to planning for their appearance in the next one, which is sometime next week, I think?
Yeah.
They overdo it sometimes.
It's a big problem that all of these films are now facing, in that they have to set up the next few films, because no film can be a standalone film anymore. It has to be part of a franchise, and it has to be building a much larger world. J.J. Abrams is working on a Star Wars film that's coming out next December. It has to lead into a trilogy.
So they're moving toward television technique, where it has to be a series. We're going to have to take a break. We're coming back. We'll talk about Godzilla when we return. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Center City partners, bringing the Charlotte Symphony Summer Pops to Romare Bearden Park. Saturday, June 14th at 5 p.m. The public event includes a food truck rally followed by a movie. Details at findyourcenter.com. Well, with the primaries over, midterm election season is in full swing. Candidates are on the stump around the country, and PACs have already launched their negative ads. Here in North Carolina, education reform and a pay raise for teachers is being debated, and we have a Senate race that may determine party control of Congress. So as a result, money will be pouring in from now through November from outside sources. And the two parties are gearing up for the race of their lives. We're going to find out what the Democrats are up to tomorrow. We'll check in with the Republicans later on. But tomorrow it's the Dems at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the highway crash that killed one person and injured comedian Tracy Morgan has revived the debate over trucker fatigue, sleep regulations in the trucking industry, and the dangers of drowsy driving.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, talking summer movies with our trio of movie critics, Sean O'Connell, a movie content director with CinemaBlend.com and NBC Charlotte. Matt Brunson is film and arts and entertainment editor for Creative Loafing, and Anne-Marie Oliva is co-founder and film and theater review editor for Arts a la Mode, Godzilla. Summer would be nothing without monster films, and Godzilla is the one. I guess Breaking Bad and Broadway All the Way star Bryan Cranston is the featured human in this. Why did he take this part? For the bucks or because he thought it was a good film, and is it?
He might tell himself it's because he thought it was a great film, but it's probably the paycheck. I'm sure it fit into his schedule. It's misleading, too, that he's the star because he's not. The star is this young up-and-comer, God help us, named Aaron Taylor Johnson, who was in Kick-Ass. He was in something
Savages.
Else. The Savages. He's going to be in the new Avengers film. He has zero personality to me. And okay. So making him the leading man doomed that film. And I didn't find that film very interesting as it is. You guys might have liked it more
than I liked it. I think he was just a vehicle. I mean, he wasn't really the star in the sense that he carried the movie. But he was appropriately bland.
Put that on the poster.
Yeah,
appropriately bland.
Appropriately bland. And but I mean, Godzilla, the
Why
monster.
Why is that appropriate?
Because, like I said, he was a vehicle. He wasn't really the star. He didn't carry it. But I did like the monster a lot. And my only complaint was that there wasn't enough of Godzilla. I really enjoyed, maybe I'm thinking back to all of those that used to be on TV. But
somebody wrote, and I don't, it could have been one of you, that they were curious about the monster itself because it looked like he'd been sitting on the ocean floor eating bonbons for the last 50 years because he's kind of round around the middle and slovenly. Rotten Tomatoes calls Godzilla the world's most revered monster. Why?
I don't even know if that's accurate.
Yeah, King Kong gets my vote.
Yeah,
because we all remember those old Godzilla movies on television.
And he doesn't appear for the first hour of the film.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Which I didn't mind that because I like the setup. But then once that hour passed, you want to see like Godzilla 24/7, and you don't. I mean, it's like he's an extra in his own movie. He just appears fleetingly.
You're going to maybe find this difficult to believe, but I have never seen a Godzilla movie. I have seen clips of Godzilla stomping on New York City and destroying people and terrorizing the world around him. Is that pretty much what he is, a mindless reptile?
No. This movie will argue that there's a larger mythology to Godzilla. If anything, I thought it overcomplicated it. It sort of talked about how whenever there are these creatures that emerge from the sea to threaten us, Godzilla is going to almost come and save us. So by the end of the movie, even though he has destroyed a major city, the tone shifts so drastically and we're asked to like cheer this monster.
Well, supposedly those other monsters did something to Godzilla's progeny or something. I mean, it does get complicated, and that's why he goes after them.
Well, if that's the case, I completely
missed that.
Yeah.
Well, you say we're supposed to root for – they want us to root for Godzilla.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
How can you root for the guy?
Well, in the sequels to the original movie, you did. He ended up becoming a hero. But – it's just – that's the problem is in the earlier movies, he's not in it a lot either. But at least there in the first Godzilla, the original one, he was the focus. Everybody talked about him when he was off screen. In this one, since he has enemies, everybody's more focused on them. And then every once in a while it's like, oh, yeah, hey, there's Godzilla coming along.
So
it's kind of like why kids like dragons, you know, where they're fascinated by dinosaurs. You know, we are. We're interested in that. We're fascinated by it.
So who's this movie aimed at?
Just special effects heads. I think just people who wanted to see.
I think kids would like
spectacle.
It. I think
kids
fans would like
of the original too. I would argue.
Is it good?
I was mixed on it.
I liked it, but that's me.
I was really bored by it. And you tapped into what you like. You said there was no Godzilla in it. There's barely any Godzilla in it. And when he shows up, it's like the last 20 minutes. There's a big monster fight, but it's a lot of exposition to get to that point with characters who I never cared about.
If they make another one, I guarantee you'll probably see more Godzilla.
Right.
Well, before we move on to other non-monster, non-action film fare, let's talk about one of the other big ones, X-Men Days of Future Past. It takes place across two time periods, so it gives lovers of the X-Men franchise a chance to see these characters at different stages of their lives. You liked this film, Matt.
Matt or me? Well, we both did. We all did.
Yes, I liked it very much. It's the one, excuse me, the first blockbuster of the season that really delivered, and it comes on the tale of X-Men First Class, which I also thought was really good. So I think this is one franchise that's doing it right.
And you gave this, Sean, four and a half out of five stars and called it the greatest X-Men movie we've seen to date. Why?
Because it juggles this huge storyline and does it so nimbly, and it's kind of fascinating that since they had this pre-existing X-Men trilogy with these original cast members, and then they had the foresight to do this First Class where they introduced younger versions of these characters set in the 60s, mm-hmm. they allowed themselves to tell this very popular time travel storyline from the X-Men comics that goes back to the 1980s, and the fans have been wanting to see Days of Future Past where older X-Men have to go back in time to prevent a cataclysmic future, and it works on paper, but you have to carry it out, you have to lay a lot of groundwork. And all of a sudden, Fox looked down, and they were like, oh, wait a second, we've laid all this groundwork. We have these older X-Men, and we have the younger X-Men, and let's bridge the gap. So they hired Bryan Singer, the original director, to come back and to helm it, and he just knows how these characters work. He understands their powers. He can keep a movie moving at a great pace.
How does he make them look young again?
Well, he uses younger actors. He uses James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender as younger versions of guys played by Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. And then Hugh Jackman's just – he made a deal with the devil somehow because he looks exactly the same, if not better, than he did years ago.
Wolverine starred over the weekend as Hugh Jackman at the Tonys.
But a talented guy. He can do everything.
He's unstoppable. He can do everything.
Sean, you say his portrayal is forceful, funny, casual, arrogant, and effortlessly cool, and the best use of Wolverine as a character in a movie ever.
Right, because he's part of an ensemble. And when Jackman can pick his moments and play off of other people, he's great. And he was able to do that in the initial X-Men movies. And then they tried to make him into a solo star, and it just wasn't as much fun as when he is the baddest ass in the room and making everybody else, you know, look not cool.
That's the strength of this movie is the casting. I think, you know, in the olden days, they used to cast B actors in these, you know, Hercules and whatever, and they got smarter. They started casting really talented actors. Mm-hmm. So they bring it up to a whole other level.
So you all three liked it.
Mm-hmm. It's great. Yep. Yeah, it's great.
Okay. On to comedy. Neighbors. This opened in May with Seth Rogen, Zac Efron, and Rose Byrne, who is from that wonderful television show with Glenn Close, and I can't remember the name of it now.
Shameless? Selfless?
Not Shameless.
Not that
one. Anyway, you didn't like this film, Anne-Marie.
I didn't. I thought it was a one-trick pony.
You said you can dress up a pig, but it's still a pig.
I did say that tonight. Yeah, I didn't like this at all. As I said, I think it's a one-trick pony. Oh, they live next door to a frat house, and then you know everything.
And they frequently shirtless Zac Efron, evidently.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the big draws, I imagine. I didn't care for it. I didn't think it was that funny. I didn't think it was that original, or creative, or crude. It was crude. I won't go into the breastfeeding incident, but it just.
How do you bring that up and not go into it?
and Matt, you say, as far as dumb comedies go, this one's not bad at all and is sure to go down even easier after a few rounds of shots or a pitcher or three at the neighborhood bar. A resounding endorsement. And you say, however, Sean, that this is a fresh, relatable comedy. How can the three of you be so far apart on this?
Because we're different people.
Yes, and comedy is very subjective.
And
I
Sean
guess.
Is a frat boy.
Now I laugh my face off at this. I found it to be very funny. And the reason I say fresh is because you see it and you think it's just going to be Animal House or Old School where the frat life is celebrated. And I appreciated that it took the angle. It really tells the story through the eyes of these parents who have this newborn and they just want, you know, peace and quiet mm-hmm. in their neighborhood. And so they decide to take the frat down from within. And the deeper they got into this scheme, it played funnier for me.
And Seth Rogen is in kind of a role reversal here, isn't he? Because he's actually playing a responsible adult against Zac Efron. I mean,
to a certain extent. Like part of the commentary is how the Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen don't want to admit that they're getting older. They think they can still hang with these young kids. And that was funny also because they can't, obviously. And the frat guys are playing them, you know, in a way that they don't even realize that they're being played. Huh. Believe me, it's dumb. But I also thought it was very funny.
So crap, great. Oh, is that what I
have? Mixed for me, not crap.
I was funnier than Jump Street. I laughed really? Harder at Neighbors than Jump Street. And Jump Street's funny.
Oh, no, I laughed.
But I laughed harder at Neighbors.
I thought Jump Street was much better.
I don't even know what that's about. It's 22 Jump Street you're talking mm-hmm. about. Yeah. Jonah Hill.
Which we just saw last night.
Channing Tatum, who has police officers go undercover at a local college. Not the first time they've gone undercover. They were at high school the last time.
Correct. And now they go to college.
So what's the deal with 22 Jump Street? Was that a TV show? Why does that sound so familiar?
Yes, it was with Johnny Depp.
Okay. What's the story there?
Just that the first movie, which was a reboot of a TV show, so not quite original, was funny, and they got off to a really good start. And every joke in this movie is just aimed at, hey, we're a sequel, and we better do the exact same thing that we did the first time because it worked, and we can't mess this up. But which is funny,
yeah, it is
but not
funny.
Over 2 hours.
Are
they
they're telegraphing that? They're telling the
completely.
Audience?
Oh, completely. A lot of the jokes, But
every
I think
joke.
They were smart jokes.
How do
so.
They do that?
They are.
They make fun of themselves, and they ask the audience to come in and join them. And I think that's what's so funny because they make references that we all got, and it's like they're winking at you. And, you know, it doesn't take itself seriously, and it's just funny. It's just stupid funny, but it's funny.
There are characters that only exist to point out the fact that they're in a sequel and that – you know, the studio gave us more money and it's bigger.
Yeah.
And
they talk about that. They're like, hey, we have new offices, you know, Ice Cube's like, I have $800 shoes on that nobody can even see.
But they're not, it's not trying to be anything that it's not, though. It is what it is, and here it is, and here we are.
And it worked.
And I thought it worked.
Yeah, there's a lot of winking at the media recently in a lot of different things. What is that about, you think? We're telling you, we know we're in a movie, or we know we're in a TV show, we know this isn't real, we know that you've seen this before, we know that we've done this joke before, we're going to do it again, here it comes, there, we did it, did you like it? What's that all about?
Well, it's a safety net for one thing. It's kind of like, we know you've seen this, so we're going to make you part of the joke, so you don't judge us too harshly. But it's interesting because A Million Ways to Die in the West kind of does the same thing from Seth MacFarlane,
the
Family Guy
man. That's where I was going next.
There you go.
I saw the trailer for this yesterday on my little computer, and I laughed out loud 4, 5, 6, 7 times. It was like uncontrollable outbursts. It was like, pah! It's like that. And it stars writer-director Seth MacFarlane, of Family Guy, Charlize Theron, and others. But you say, Matt, this film has barely enough worthy gags to fill out even one movie. So did I see all the good stuff in the trailer?
Movie? Yeah, I put 15 minutes, and you did. I guess it was all in the trailer. Because this is
– it was very funny.
It's kind of like the opposite of 22 Jump Street. It's like, hey, look at us. We're being funny, but it's not. And a lot of the problem is that Seth MacFarlane cast himself in the leading role instead of an accomplished actor like he did in Ted.
You call that a disastrous decision.
Mm-hmm.
All but guaranteeing the film has little chance of succeeding. Why?
He's more like a just a gag machine, a stand-up comic. He's not like in Ted, he had Mark Wahlberg, who's an actor and knows how to be funny. And in this one, he's just kind of standing around, and you have real actors like Charlize Theron and Liam Neeson around him, and he just is shown up for the imposter that he is in terms of being an actor.
Well, he's not really an actor. I think everybody knows that.
Yeah, but for the movie to work, it would have been better to have an actor.
So is it a big ego trip? Is that why he did it?
Oh, totally. It's funny at the beginning because it's like a film by Seth MacFarlane, starring Seth MacFarlane, written by Seth MacFarlane, produced by, catering by, key grip by.
Does it really say that?
No. But it should. I added a couple in. But
you don't know. He might have baked some brownies or something.
But when you make Ted money, you get a chance to do that, I guess. The studio is very happy with you, and they give you.
They won't after this.
They give you Cate Blanchett.
So have you all seen $1 Million?
I have not seen it.
Million Ways to Die in the West?
I did not. We did have a screening, but the buzz prior to it was so odorous that I decided
tell me
a night at home would be better.
Wait. Yes. You mean critics prejudge a film based on the buzz? You're supposed to be setting the buzz.
Well, no. They screened it for friends of mine in other cities, and Charlotte, being the fourth-rate market that we are, got a screening 2 weeks later. So enough of them had told me it's a dud that I trusted their opinion.
Whereas I loved Ted, so I went in thinking it was going to be really funny, and it wasn't.
Sometimes other critics save critics.
We have to stop. You just called us a fourth-rate market.
What are we, fifth, sixth?
I don't know. You tell me.
Third? Are we third? Could we get up to third? I don't know.
We are the 16th largest city in America. How can we be fourth-rate?
Hollywood does not feel that way about us. Yeah. Primarily, if you notice, we have not talked about a single interesting independent film yet. And it's primarily because Charlotte still fights to get interesting films.
We could talk about Belle, which was at the Manor. Jorge on Facebook says Jeremy Piven talking about Mr. Selfridge. I don't know when we were talking about Mr. Selfridge. Said no one does a historical drama like the Brits. Belle is no exception. Great movie, and it's inspired by the illegitimate mixed race daughter of Admiral Sir John Lindsay. You all saw it?
It was very good.
Mm-hmm. It was good.
I thought it was good.
But it arrives with little fanfare in our market. If you're not paying very close attention to films that are opening at the Manor, at Park Terrace, down at Ballantyne Village, these films don't get the attention that they deserve.
But the audience for films at Park Terrace and the Manor know that those two theaters screen these films regularly. The quality of what they screen, like that Hotel Budapest film, are really high. Is that the entire audience, the people that sit in those two theaters for those films? That's the entire Charlotte audience for these films?
Some of them.
Or could they make it with a wider release on more screens?
Well, they need to promote it too, and a lot of the independent movies, for whatever reason, like Chef, I know Sean saw it, I don't know if you did, but
no.
It wasn't screened here. That's been getting a lot of good buzz on the independent circuit. It's doing fairly well.
It's one of the best films I've seen this year.
Yeah, and we didn't have a screening here for it. It's like they were just like, oh, what, Charlotte? We're just going to dump it in that market.
Well, is that because Charlotte doesn't have a big enough audience for that, or is it because we're the 16th and not the fifth largest city in America, or the fourth-rate city, as you call it?
Well, when you call it 16th, highest, what movie studios pay attention to, I've been told, is the amount of tickets sold. So until we can generate more theaters or show up more at the box office, we are not going to rank that high. Like our media market has nothing to do with the way the studios view us. Studios are always going to view us on the amount of tickets that they are selling.
So we're not moviegoers?
No.
No, we're not moviegoers. No, although a long time ago, a rep did tell me that the numbers for the Beverly Hills Hillbillies movie was astronomical here in Charlotte.
That's really odd to me because we are, as you say, a lower tier city, and yet we get the first run in many cases of Broadway tours that come through town. Now, that's a much more expensive ticket than a movie ticket, and yet we're packing the houses for those, and we get the first-run tours. Why?
Well, the Blumenthal does a fantastic job of getting those plays here. So, I mean, I give them all the credit for that.
Okay, we have to stop. We're going to come back and talk more about movies in just a couple of seconds with our trio of movie critics on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. The highway crash that killed one person and injured comedian Tracy Morgan has revived the debate over trucker fatigue, sleep regulations in the trucking industry, and the dangers of drowsy driving. The topic of conversation on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation about summer movies, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Twitter or Facebook will get you to us, and we're coming right back.
Saturday and Sunday mornings on WFAE, we bring you the week's news, but we might also take you along on an alligator hunt.
So right now we're in the flooded forest, and there's a bunch of cypress trees around with Spanish moss looking for the alligator snout, but right now it's just real flat.
News, conversations, and the unexpected. Weekend mornings from 8 to 10. It's Weekend Edition on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Anne-Marie Oliva, co-founder and film and theater review editor for ArtsAlaMode.com. Matt Brunson is film arts and entertainment and senior editor at Creative Loafing, and Sean O'Connell is movie content director for CinemaBlend.com and appears regularly on NBC Charlotte. We're talking about movies. I'm still reeling from the fourth-rate city that they view us as.
I say that with love.
Do you? What?
I say that with – I mean, I still choose to work out of here. There are great reasons to be in Charlotte.
Yeah.
But exposure to the film community is not
one. Why don't we go to the movies more? If that's the problem, what is it about Charlotte that doesn't go to the movies?
Well, I don't know. Like, that's interesting because
– And why are we doing this show if nobody goes to the movies?
We are sandwiched between Atlanta, which is a big market that goes to the movies. And I think we're eclipsed by Raleigh-Durham, which is a college town, and younger audiences go to movies.
Right.
So the studios view Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill, that triangle area – as a more viable market than Charlotte does, because for whatever reason and we haven't added a ton of new theaters. We added the Epicenter, that helped, but we used to have more multiplexes in the area, and so it meant more people were going.
We have more? We have fewer now than we did?
We have fewer now than we did. Sure, there was the one out on Monroe Road there anymore.
Right. Okay.
Not a lot.
So there are a lot of factors. We've been talking about them. Television's getting bigger. The economy went down, so people don't want to spend as much. The movies that are coming out aren't as interesting to people.
The
they don't want to see another
Spider-Man.
The
theaters say, it costs them a lot of money, that the studios take a lot of their money when a movie opens, mm-hmm. and they don't start making money until a certain period of time. And that's why they have to charge so much for the popcorn and all those things. That's what they make their money on.
Well, and if a family wants to go to the movies, and now all your animated efforts are in 3D,
right.
You're looking at $100 off the bat.
Yeah.
If a family wants to go see How to Train Your Dragon 2, which is coming out, and the only reason to see that movie is to see it in 3D, because the 3D is spectacular, but the story is – it's fine. It is what it is. You're looking at $100, and not every family can do that or wants to do that.
Exactly. All right, let's talk about Blended, which Anne-Marie described as a family-oriented comedy, despite the fact that it stars Adam Sandler, and it hasn't done well, evidently, at all. But, Sean, you gave it 3.5 stars. So Sandler's out there again with Drew Barrymore. They seem to have chemistry together. Why haven't audiences taken to this film?
Yeah, that's a good question because, I mean, he'll crank out a grown-ups film, and it'll make money in its sleep, and they're unwatchable. But this one, and listen, it is what it is. I get it. But I really like their chemistry together. And maybe I was anticipating the relentless, bathroom humor. And there was some of that, because you are going to get that with his films. But I thought there was enough of a story and enough of an attempt at human emotion that I was more generous than I probably should have been. Attempts. And they do have good chemistry together. Like the two of them.
She makes him better.
She does.
Which is saying a lot. Mm-hmm. Because to me, Adam Sandler is the luckiest man in show business. So, I mean, kids may like it. There are kids in the movie, and it's silly, and so maybe they'll get something out of it. And I like Drew Barrymore so much. She has a sweetness about her, but
I miss her as a leading lady.
Yeah.
I want her in more things.
I didn't see it, but I did see a quote by Adam Sandler where he said he's making movies now where he can go on vacation. like this in Grown Ups, you know, where he doesn't have to do any effort and he gets a nice trip. I think that contempt is showing through, and that's why audiences aren't going.
And where's this film shot? Hawaii?
Africa.
Africa.
Yeah. Okay. In a beautiful resort.
Yeah, but they don't show much of Africa.
No, really. No, no. It's all of the resort.
He just wanted to go there.
Yeah.
Okay. Jonathan emails, has your panel seen Words and Pictures? I saw it a few nights ago and absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I saw it too. I think it was good. I thought Juliette Binoche and Clive Owen were terrific. The story is not all that original, but sometimes I felt like I was in a classroom being instructed. Mm-hmm. But overall, better more than not good. So I'm kind of mixed on it.
Was this a screening?
It was a screening.
Where will this play when it plays?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I'm not sure, but I'm sure it's going to be just a couple of theaters. Yeah. But I liked it too. I thought it was going to be
all right. We talked a little bit about Edge of Tomorrow, which is the Tom Cruise film, which got rave reviews and a lukewarm reception from the audience. And last week, I think it was eclipsed by a small film, The Fault in Our Stars. Both of these titles, Edge of Tomorrow and Fault in Our Stars, sound like soap opera titles to me. But for a small film to beat out a big blockbuster actually sounds encouraging. Is it?
Well, I think The Fault in Our Stars is an unusual situation because it's based on the best-selling book by John Green, which it's about childhood cancer, a couple that have childhood cancer. And, of course, the topic already is sad, and then you add the tone of both the book and the movie are, I think, just right because it's not – they don't want to be their cancer. They are people with cancer, and I think it just really is very realistic about a young girl who wants the experiences of adolescence.
Right.
But because of the cancer, she's limited, and she never thinks she's going to find it. So it's – wow, take tissues.
Yeah, it's one of those counter-programming movies they do in the summer where they take a movie that's not a big special effects film, and sometimes they they hit a home run with them, and they did with this one. I'm glad they did. Sorry Edge of Tomorrow didn't do as well, but I really liked Fault in Our Stars.
Both of you said to take tissues in your reviews of this film, and you say the book and the film – I think, Matt, you said the book and the film have a respect for the young audience. That was you, Anne. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Do young audiences go to see tearjerkers about themselves?
Yeah, that's who saw it opening weekend.
I mean, if you could have heard the audience sobbing, it really touches teenagers. And I think because it respects them, and I think he did something very smart. He included the parents. A lot of times you see these movies about young people, and it's like, you know, we want to be orphans.
Or they're complete idiots.
Yeah. But when a child has cancer, I mean, the parents go through some awful, awful experiences too. So I think overall, it just the tone of it, as I said before, was really correct.
Mm. And you said, Matt, although you gave it 3.5 stars, you sound a little bit like you're hedging your bet on this when you say one person's soul-rattling catharsis might be another's Hallmark greeting card. Which is this?
Well, for me, it's the first, but it's the type of movie where I've had so many people tell me, oh, I'm not going to go see that because it just looks like another, you know, lame soap opera, like you say. But I don't think that. I think it's really moving. It's so much better than all these types of movies where the characters feel more like pawns for whatever disease they have. Here, I felt these were real individuals, and you had really good actors nailing these parts.
Okay. As long as we're talking about young audiences, let's turn our attention to Disney's Maleficent, the film about the wicked stepmother in Sleeping Beauty. She has escaped the confines of animation and is fully realized by Angelina Jolie. What a headdress. This is this is her backstory, Maleficent's backstory. And Anne-Marie, you say the conflicted Maleficent wavers and is not true to her most evil self. What's the end result of that?
Well, I think it was inconsistent. I think Angelina Jolie is magnificent. She really pulled it off. But fairy tales have lasted for centuries for a reason. They tell the truth. You know, the evil guy does not become the nice guy. You know, the witch in Hansel and Gretel does not become a grandmotherly type. And I think it's hedging its bets. And for that reason, I found a problem with the story, not with the with the acting or the visuals.
And you said, Matt, Maleficent is a jolly good time. That could have been your headline writer. But you say that Maleficent's story as a prequel isn't true to the story we already know. That's a big mistake?
Not for me. At first I thought it would be, because unlike Wicked, which kind of takes the story of the witch and smoothly integrates it into the story we know, Wizard of Oz, this one actually changes the fairy tale. But once I realized it was doing that, I didn't mind, because Angelina Jolie is so great in the movie. And like she said, it has a really cool visual style.
And Sean, you pointed out in one of your columns that just because a movie has a Disney label on it doesn't mean it's suitable for all ages. So is this a kid's film?
It depends. I have a 10-year-old and 6-year-old, and they had no interest in seeing it. And they've been bombarded by the ads on the television shows that they watch.
They're boys.
Maybe that's what it is.
I think that's a lot.
But it's interesting. Like, even after the fact, now that I've seen it, and I totally agree with Amory that it was just inconsistent. I thought it was a bad idea to set the story from the perspective of the villain. Brendan was trying to describe one of the scenes that he'd seen on the television show, and he didn't know what to call Maleficent. He's like, the bad guy in that movie, wait, is she the good guy? And even he's confused by the commercials. And I'm like, Brendan, I can't even explain it to you. I've seen the movie. So it the way that it shifted tones and perspectives – I think most of it's going to go over the heads of kids. There's this revenge. It's a revenge fantasy in the middle of this movie that I think is really not aimed at children. I think there's a lot of interesting things for them to look at initially with fairies and creatures, but all of that gets sort of thrown by the wayside.
I don't think it's for the youngest. I think parents really have to decide if their child can handle it.
Right. And in the end of the movie, there's a death of a the resolution is killing off a major character, and I thought that was a little harsh.
Yeah.
You know, in the earlier days, when Disney used to have two brands. They had the Disney brand for kids' movies, and you knew that if you went to a Disney film, it was for kids. And if they had a film that was slightly older in its orientation, they put it under the Buena Vista mark. Do they not do that anymore?
Well, Disney's absorbed so many different companies, they probably assume that either Pixar, excuse me, or their own animation brand. Boy, what happened to my voice? is what's going to lure people. But now they do so many of these live-action tellings. They get Johnny Depp for Alice in Wonderland. They're going to do a Sleeping Beauty. They're trying to walk this line now between these live-action adaptations, and I think it's a difficult one to do.
Yeah. Are they not afraid of watering down the impact, of the long-lasting impact of those
Apparently
classic
not.
Animation
Oh, animated well, movies? I thought you were going to say the label, and it's like Disney is now such a brand name that, like, even the Avengers is Marvel's and Disney's the Avengers.
But when you have classics like Sleeping Beauty in your catalog,
right,
and you suddenly remake them as live-action films, doesn't that not only take away from people wanting to rent the animated version, but also what happens in the theme parks where they're duplicating the animated version?
I think Wicked started a trend, because now we have all these origin stories coming out. And
but I would argue that those awful straight-to-video sequels, like, you know, Cinderella 2 and Little Mermaid 2 do more damage, because those things are just really bad.
Okay. Another film aimed at kids, How to Train Your Dragon 2. It's a DreamWorks animation film, follow-up to their successful 2010 film. I think it was you, Sean, who said that the reason you see this is for the 3D.
Right, because there are a lot of aerial sequences where these Vikings adopt these dragons, and they use them to ride on, and so it's a lot of flying and swooping through the clouds, and it's just not a world that I've connected with yet over the course of the two films. I liked the first one. I didn't need to see a second one. I liked this second one, but it didn't blow me away, and it's not like I'm hungering for a third and a fourth, although they're planning on making them. But the first one was very successful, and they really do find a way to incorporate 3D. 3D is just easier for animation because of the way that the technology works, and the 3D is spectacular in this. But I'm not yet invested in this story, and we're two movies into it.
So. I'm not invested in 3D. The things that I've seen in 3D, some are really interesting. What was the one?
Avatar?
Avatar.
Right.
I thought that was great in 3D, but I'm still not sure it's worth the extra money. I just don't.
I think it isn't most of the time. Hugo was good in 3D, too, from a couple of years ago. But, yeah, most of the time it's really not worth it.
But it's not going away.
No.
I know this hasn't come out yet, and I know that you may not have seen it yet, but there's a film called Boyhood.
Oh, I've seen it.
You have seen it.
Oh, it's spectacular.
This is Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, Richard Linklater, and a boy who I don't know his name.
I forget his name, too.
But they started – this film has been in progress for 12 years, and they actually watched this actor, this boy, grow up on screen in the course of this movie. It's never been done before. Is it worth it?
Yes, completely. and it's not just that trick, although that the trick is the big selling point. Linklater's done these before trilogies. He did Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and the most recent one, Before Midnight. And if anyone's seen those, they're just these rambling sort of in the moment, checking in with these characters as they evolve, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. And that's this. It tells the story of a family over the course of 12 years. He kept the cast together. He filmed them for a couple of weeks every year. And it doesn't tell any large story that you're following. It's just a day in the life of where these characters would be over the course of their lives. The couple is separating. The kids are going into different schools. It's nothing really exciting, but as you're watching it unfold and you're watching these actors live these lives.
And get older. Legitimately older.
Yeah. I mean, it follows this one kid from the time that he's a kindergartner until he goes away to college. And afterwards, you start to think about all the things that could have gone wrong. Like, what if, you know, just one of them got tired of doing it?
Or what
if we lost one of the actors? The whole experiment would be gone. So I guess that's why he had to eventually cap it, because he was just flirting with disaster.
When you start with a kid in kindergarten,
right,
who's doing a movie because maybe mommy and daddy wanted him to be a movie actor. When he gets to be a teenager, he may not want to do this anymore.
Right.
Then what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a scary thing. So I salute him for taking on the risk.
It is compelling, and you have to find it. I think it comes out in July. It's going to go wider in July. I hope we get it in July. It's really, really good.
Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton star in And So It Goes beginning in July. Have you seen that yet?
Mm-mm.
Not yet.
No. We need another Planet of the Apes movie. Dawn of Planet of the Apes comes out again in July. Jersey Boys is coming out later this month. Have we seen Jersey Boys yet?
Not yet. Next week.
Josh wonders, and I only have a couple of seconds left, if you could recommend a site for learning how to appreciate movies more deeply.
That's interesting. In what way? I mean, like a list of movies to watch or about filmmaking?
A canon list is what he writes here. But, I mean, are there books or play?
Oh, there's many books about appreciating movies.
I would go with the old standbys like Pauline Kael and Roger Ebert.
I was just going to say Pauline Kael.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no people.
Or the AFI has lists of movies to watch like by genre and just start at the top and work your way through.
Well, thank you all. It's always fun when you guys come here. Anne-Marie Oliva with Arts a la Mode, Matt Brunson with Creative Loafing, Sean O'Connell with the CinemaBlend.com and NBC Charlotte. You can find all these things out there in your universe. Thanks for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yep.